we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
It was with reluctance that I decided the country needs this election. But it is with strong conviction that I say it is necessary to secure the strong and stable leadership the country needs to see us through Brexit and beyond.
Our proposal is a government for the many, not the few. Our proposals are of hope for the many all over this country. And I'm very proud to present our manifesto for the many, not the few. Thank you very much.
1 million people, many of them in work, forced to rely on charity for food. 1 in 4 children living in poverty. 13.5 million people living in poverty. Homelessness, including rough sleeping, at a 30-year high. Real wages down. The worst housing crisis of any advanced industrialised economy. Healthcare in crisis. The most ramshackle, anarchic, expensive and costly rail system in Europe. The highest prison population in Western Europe. Crime up, suicides up. All this at the same time as the richest 1,000 people in the country saw their wealth increase by 14% in the past year. This is not Britain in 1817 I'm talking about here. This is Britain in 2017, thus ensuring that the stakes involved in the country's upcoming general election on June 8th could not be higher. And isn't it instructive how, with this election looming, the Tory political and media establishment is throwing everything, bar the kitchen sink, at the Labour Party's socialist leader Jeremy Corbyn. He's dredging up positions he held on the IRA in the 1980s, demonstrations he attended, along with speeches and statements he made decades ago. It all points to the fact that despite spending the past year dismissing Corbyn as the most inept, feckless and incompetent leader of the opposition there has ever been since Michael Foot, who by the way led the party in the early 1980s and who, surprise surprise, also happened to be a socialist, despite all of this, the Tory establishment is worried about Jeremy Corbyn, and with good reason. Corbyn's election manifesto, just launched, constitutes the most transformative and radical programme for government the UK has seen in over a generation. It is one that plants its colours squarely on the side of the country's working class and its poor, pledging to reverse decades whereby successive governments have worshipped at the altar of the free market, allowing blind economic forces to dictate every aspect of government policy, embracing thereby the economy as a tyrant over the lives of ordinary working people rather than a servant of their needs. In this regard, austerity, rolled out as the answer to the global financial crash of 2007, has nothing to do with economics and everything to do with ideology, specifically the unleashing of a class war with the objective of blaming the poor and working people for the criminal negligence of the rich, whose greed was responsible for the aforementioned crash. It doesn't have to be this way, you know. We can have a society based not on greed but on justice, based not on despair but on dignity. They accuse Corbyn of wishing to drag the country back to the 1970s, a supposed decade of doom and gloom in Britain. This is utter nonsense. I grew up in the 1970s, and let me tell you, for working people in Britain, it was a virtual paradise compared to today. Free dental care, free eye care, free school meals for all children, decent wages and conditions, trade union rights, a sense of community that is sorely lacking now. And thinking about it, to label these things as free is a misnomer. They weren't free. They were paid for out of general taxation. And taxation, as every smart person out there knows, is the price we pay for civilization, i.e. the more taxation, the more civilization, and vice versa. So Jeremy Corbyn, with a manifesto that will drag Britain not back to the 1970s, but out of the 1870s, has reignited the kind of class and political consciousness that I have not witnessed in over three decades as a British citizen. It challenges in every particular a political establishment that has extended itself in being a government of the rich, by the rich, and for the rich. And lastly, on foreign policy, Just consider the difference between a sitting Tory government whose Defence Secretary, Michael Fallon, recently boasted of the Prime Minister Theresa May's willingness to launch a preemptive nuclear strike in certain circumstances, and a leader of the opposition in Jeremy Corbyn, who has pledged to establish a Ministry of Peace if elected. And just consider the difference between a government that slavishly attaches itself to the coattails of Washington and a leader of the opposition who does and who will not. Make no mistake, this UK general election on June 8th could not be more important. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, joining me to discuss the upcoming UK general election on June 8th, I'm delighted to be joined by my old friend Marcus Papadopoulos. Marcus is the editor of the Political Politics First magazine in Westminster. He's a writer, broadcaster, and a political analyst with an expertise on British politics. Marcus, welcome back to Hard Facts.
Hello, John, and it's a pleasure to be back on your show.
Well, as the man said, the best of times and the worst of times as this election draws near, isn't it? I'm minded of the quote by Napoleon Bonaparte. It's a fantastic quote, and he said, "Four hostile newspapers are more to be feared than 1,000 bayonets." And I think this applies to the treatment that we've been seeing meted out to Jeremy Corbyn. He's been through the ringer, if truth be told, since he was elected Labour leader at the end of 2015. But this period has been at its most intense. Give me your thoughts on this campaign of demonisation that we've been witnessing against Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn has been demonised ever since he became a Member of Parliament at the 1983 general election. He has been demonised by the British establishment, and in particular the Conservative Party and the right-wing media. So Jeremy is a very determined, a very thick-skinned man. He's used to the personal attacks, which we are seeing today during this election campaign, and he's used to the totally unsubstantiated, uncorroborated, nasty accusations against him.
These are accusations that he's a terrorist sympathiser, that he hates Britain, yes, and he's, yes, not a patriot and all that stuff, yeah.
Yes, I mean, if we want to talk about the IRA, well, let's have that discussion. Ted Heath, Harold Wilson, James Callaghan, Margaret Thatcher and John Major were all speaking to representatives of the IRA during the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
Okay.
The difference between them and Jeremy Corbyn is that Jeremy was doing it publicly, but those prime ministers were doing it privately. And today, of course, we see Theresa May meeting with representatives of Sinn Féin, and we even see the Queen meeting with representatives of the IRA. So once again, these conservative politicians and conservative journalists who are saying that Jeremy is a terrorist sympathiser, they're simply distorting the truth. And the other accusation against Jeremy, that he is a threat to British national security. Well, let's just clarify something, shall we? Jeremy has opposed all of Britain's military adventures in the world since he became an MP in 1983, which means he opposed the bombing of Serbia in 1999. He opposed the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. He opposed the destabilizing of Libya, the destabilizing of Syria. He has opposed the government of David Cameron and the government of Theresa May's support for Wahhabist terrorist groups in Syria. So who is the threat to British national security? It is the Conservative government through their support to Wahhabist groups in Syria, through having supported Wahhabist groups in Libya, who have increased the terrorist threat to Britain tenfold. So it is not Jeremy. It is actually the Conservative government. And if we want to go down the pathway of who is treacherous, who is a traitor, well, it's certainly not Jeremy. It's the Conservative government by increasing that terrorist threat to ordinary British people across the UK in British towns and cities.
That's a fantastically cogent point, Marcus. I mean, I'm minded of the words of the Roman historian Tacitus when he talked about the Romans making a desert and calling it peace. And this seems to me to describe to a T the Western foreign policy, with Britain playing a key role in that foreign policy over the last generation. And as you rightly point out, it has done nothing but sow chaos and carnage, and it's threatened the security of the British public. But extending that metaphor regarding Tacitus, we can also say that Jeremy's also opposed to, domestically, the Tory policy of making a dystopia and calling it society. And when you rightly talk about Wahhabism, these are the people who are attacking Jeremy Corbyn for the positions he held on the IRA, his willingness to talk to the IRA during the Troubles. These are the same people who still today are shamelessly cavorting with the medieval Saudi kleptocracy, selling them billions of pounds worth of weapons which they're using to slaughter children and other civilians in Yemen as we speak. People, a government under whom women have zero rights whatever, treated as chattel, where people are beheaded, people are flogged for calling for democracy, where human rights do not exist. I mean, the very term is not even in the vocabulary of this Saudi kleptocracy. This hypocrisy is really nauseating, is it not?
Yes, it is. And I would also like to add two other gruesome facts about Saudi Arabia. Firstly, they crucify people there. Literally, they crucify people. And also, they gouge people's eyes out in public as well. And all of that is done on a Friday, the holy day in Islam. But you know, John, if in Britain we had a balanced, responsible, independent and intelligent media, then most people in the UK would understand the true nature of Saudi Arabia. Yeah. They would know that not only is Saudi Arabia a repugnant country at home, but it is also a repugnant country abroad. It is the leading exporter of Islamic extremism and terrorism to the world. And if people in Britain knew that, then no way could Theresa May make the argument that British security is safe in her hands, in the hands of a Conservative government, because the Conservative government and the Conservative Party have extensive ties, extensive deep-rooted relationships with Saudi Arabia. And just before Christmas last year, a motion was put forward in the House of Commons by a Labour MP to condemn the Saudi war in Yemen. And one after another of Conservative MPs turned up to make out that Saudi Arabia is an essential ally in the fight against terrorism and is a true friend of Britain. Well, if you do your research, you'll find out these Conservative MPs, directly or indirectly, have business ties to Saudi Arabia. They go on all paid expenses trips to Saudi Arabia, expenses paid by the Saudi government. So it really is terrible, terrible injustice that British people could end up voting on June the 8th for Theresa May, when Theresa May and her Conservative government are supporting a country which is targeting British people in their homes, in their on their streets, on trains, through their evil, repellent ideology, which is Wahhabism.
Indeed. Marcus, bringing it back to domestic politics, I want to discuss, if we can, austerity. Yes. Austerity was rolled out by the Tory coalition government. And by the way, let's not forget the role of the Lib Dems in supporting this government. They're trying to rebrand themselves as a party of the people, but they broke most of their manifesto pledges in 2010. Tuition fees, they committed themselves to abolishing or tuition fees for university students in England and Wales. They roll back on that. Tuition fees are now up to £9,000 a year. And they supported this Tory government as it imposed the most brutal and extreme austerity programme, or one of the most brutal of any G20 country, in response to the global economic crash of 2007-2008, which was caused by a deregulated and out-of-control banking and financial sector. It was caused by private greed. Now, the Tories, very cleverly, I think, they managed to, in the minds of enough people in the public, to turn what was an economic crisis, as I say, rooted in private greed, into one that was rooted in a crisis of public spending and a bloated public sector, in their terminology. Now, austerity has been a disaster. We're talking about an economic crisis that ushered in the worst economic recessions we've seen since the 1930s. But austerity is not anything to do with economics, as I said in my introduction. It's everything to do with ideology. They used that economic crash as a pretext to transfer wealth from the poor to the rich. Indeed, they used it. It was their economic 9/11 in this regard, to wage what I describe as a class war. And economically, it hasn't worked, because we're now, the UK is officially enjoying the slowest recovery from a recession since records began, because what it's done is it's sucked aggregate demand out of the economy. It has destroyed the purchasing power of millions of consumers in this country, the poor. And what that does, in the context of an economy that's based on consumer spending, it has obviously followed its own downward spiral. Now, I've said before, no business creates jobs. No businessman in Britain or anywhere else where the free market system holds sway creates a job. Consumers create jobs, Marcus, because it's their spending that creates the demand to which businesses and businessmen respond by creating jobs or expanding their existing business to meet that demand. Give me your views on austerity and the damage it has wrought to the lives of millions of working people, food banks, benefit sanctions, despair, suicide rate up, all the rest of it. Give me your thoughts on the extent of this damage, because I don't think a lot of our international audience understands the extent to which the sixth richest economy in the world has 19th century Dickensian levels of poverty in 2017.
There's no question about it that the austerity measures which began to be introduced following the 2010 general election were ideologically driven. Senior civil servants in Whitehall told the Conservative Prime Minister at the time, David Cameron, they told the Chancellor at the time, George Osborne, that there should not be blanket cuts. There should be specific cuts. But of course, Cameron and Osborne, they went ahead like a steamroller. And as a result of the austerity measures, which are still being implemented today under the new Conservative Prime Minister, Theresa May, millions of people up and down Britain are experiencing terrible levels of injustice, terrible levels of pain and suffering. There are 4 million children living in poverty in Britain. There are over 1.5 million, maybe 2 million people in Britain dependent on food banks. There are poor families, elderly people across the country who during the autumn months and the winter months are scared to turn their heating on out of fear of how much they will have to pay when the bill arrives and they won't be able to afford it. So many of them have, if not literally frozen to death in their homes, have become exceptionally ill. Now, what sort of society is that?
Marcus, hold that thought. We're going to answer that question in the second half of the show. Join me after the break. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of this episode of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with Marcus Papadopoulos, the editor of Politics First magazine, political analyst and broadcaster. We're discussing the upcoming UK general election on June 8th. Marcus, sorry, I had to interrupt you there for the break, but you were really rooting and identifying the extreme hardship wrought by austerity, Tory austerity, since 2010. Now, Corbyn is the antithesis of that. He is the first Labour leader in a generation who is offering a real change. He's not tinkering around the edges with the system. He's talking about re-rationalising the rail system, as I averred, is the worst in Europe. Anybody who's travelled to Europe from the UK and taken a train will think they're in a different world, given the difference. It's overpriced, it's costly. It's actually cost the Exchequer more money than it would have if it was in public hands, because of the subsidies that are being paid out to these private operators who have enjoyed a monopoly. He's talking about setting up a state-owned energy company to keep energy prices down. Again, energy was privatised under the Tories by Margaret Thatcher. It's been a disaster for working people. Inefficient, costly, and it's instituted a monopoly. He's talking about taxing the rich and trying to raise the incomes of the poor and working people. Now, people say that we can't afford these things. This is what the Tories are saying, you know, the old canard when it comes to labour, that, you know, they overspend and they get us into debt and so forth. Debt is not necessarily a bad thing. I want to remind the listeners that after the Second World War, the British economy was in absolute ruins, as was every other economy that took part in that war, with the exception of the United States, whose economy boomed on the back of the war. But the British economy was in absolute ruins. I think the national debt was up to about 150%, maybe even higher, maybe between 150 and 200% of GDP. And despite this, the welfare state was rolled out. The National Health Service, where every citizen enjoyed free healthcare at the point of need, regardless of wealth, regardless of background. The building of council housing to meet the demand for housing for working class people. National insurance, state pensions, the whole lot. Now, that was a glowing testament to a government committed to a society based on justice and human solidarity. They're telling us we can't afford that today, despite the national debt, I think, is around 60% of GDP, which is not high, either historically or based with other equivalent economies in the world. We can't afford this, Marcus, can't we? We can't afford Jeremy Corbyn's programme. Give me your thoughts.
We certainly can. And also the Labour manifesto has been costed by senior economists who are highly respected, not just in Britain, but abroad. And Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour manifesto represent a serious threat to the Conservative Party, which is ultimately a serious threat to the British establishment, because, of course, historically speaking, the Conservative Party is the party of the British establishment. And let's just have a look at some of the policies in the Labour manifesto, and we will see just how humane they are, just how moral they are. For example, renationalising water. Water is a fundamental human right, a fundamental human necessity. The fact that it is privatised in Britain is immoral, is obscene. Why are people having to spend hundreds of pounds every single year, pushing them even further into poverty? Because they require a fundamental human right, a fundamental human necessity. The Labour manifesto talks about renationalising the trains. On the 1st of January each year, train fares, they go up. They are one of the highest in the world. The service, generally speaking, is poor. And of course, the fact that train fares are so expensive in Britain means that people's salaries, which are not going up, by the way, are being reduced even further because of what they have to pay on the trains. And then the Labour manifesto talks about renationalising energy, so electricity and gas. You know, once again, during the autumn and winter months, gas, keeping warm in your home, is a human necessity. We should not be paying hundreds of pounds every month or every quarterly, which adds up to thousands of pounds, just to keep warm. And the Conservatives can say that financially that's not possible and that the money isn't there. But the Conservatives find money for Trident, which is estimated to be over £100 billion pounds.
Sorry, that's Trident. That's Britain's nuclear deterrent, nuclear arsenal, just in case people don't
nuclear,
know.
That's right. The nuclear deterrent, though, of course, it's not an independent nuclear deterrent, because for Britain to use Trident, they have to have permission from the Americans, because Trident is an American system. So the Conservatives can find hundreds of billions of pounds for wars for a nuclear system, which, quite frankly, is not going to be used. It's simply about allowing Britain to remain on the United Nations Security Council and enabling British politicians to regard Britain, to project Britain on the international stage as a great power. Well, that is a facade. And, you know, John, I'd like to make another point, seeing that we're talking about morality here. Theresa May and the Conservative Manifesto have said that they want to bring back fox hunting in England and Wales. That is an affront to democracy, an affront to morality. It is an affront to democracy because over 80% of people in Britain support the Hunting Act, which bans the hunting of
wild
animals.
Marcus, quickly, just quickly, explain exactly what fox hunting involves in Britain. Explain how it works.
It involves riders on horseback, up to 10, 15 horses with hunters riding them, with a pack of dogs, 20 to 30, chasing a fox for miles upon miles upon miles, for hours, until the poor fox is exhausted, is terrified, is trapped, and then the hunters, they unleash the pack of dogs, the hounds, onto this single fox. And of course, the fox is, literally speaking, torn to shreds. And that is what the Conservative government, that is what Theresa May wants to bring back. She's ignoring the fact that over 80% of the British people support the ban on fox hunting. And what this is all about is the Conservative Party carrying out the orders of a tiny, tiny percentage of the British population, not even 1%, i.e. the hunting community, who are drawn from the British establishment and who donate millions and millions of pounds each year to the Conservative Party. So Theresa May is ignoring democracy. She's ignoring that the majority of British people do not want fox hunting back. And at the same time, she wants to re-legalise it simply because the hunting community are an integral part of the Conservative Party. And John, people in the Conservative government and Theresa May talk about their party being civilised, talk about their government being civilised. Well, how would they like it if 20 dogs were attacking them and tearing their face to pieces, tearing their throat to pieces, tearing their intestines out? How would they like that?
Marcus, you've just summed up to a T the rotten creed that is conservatism. I'm minded of the words of Albert Camus, which, to paraphrase, are, "Government without ethics is a wild beast loosed upon this world." You've been listening to Marcus Papadopoulos. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.